32 times apiece by the stainless steel machine in the kitchen. I see it purse sectioned lips like a vacuum cleaner hose and spurt a clot of chewed up ham onto a plate with a barnyard sound. The black boys stoke the sucking pink mouths of the vegetables a shade too fast for swallowing, and the mechanical soft squeezes out down their little knobs of chins onto the greens. The black boys cuss the vegetables and ream the mouths bigger with a twisting motion of the spoon, like coring a rotten apple.
This old fart blast, he coming a piece of it before my very eyes. I can't tell no more if I'm feeding him bacon puree or chunks of his own fucking tongue.
7:30, back to the day room. The big nurse looks out through her special glass, always polished till you can't tell it's there, and nods at what she sees, reaches up, and tears a sheet off her calendar, one day closer to the goal. She pushes a button for things to start. I hear the whir-up of a big sheet of tin being shook someplace. Everybody come to order. Acutes, sit on your side of the day room and wait for cards and Monopoly games to be brought out. Chronics, sit on your side and wait for puzzles from the Red Cross box. Ellis, go to your place at the wall, hands up to receive the nails and pee running down your leg. Pete, wag your head like a puppet. Scanlan, work your knobby hands on the table in front of you, constructing a make-believe bomb to blow up a make-believe world. Harding, begin talking, waving your dove hands in the air, then trap them under your armpits, because grown men aren't supposed to wave their pretty hands that way. Seafelt, begin moaning about your teeth hurting and your hair falling out. Everybody, breath in and out. In perfect order. Hearts all beating at the rate the OD cards have ordered. Sound of matched cylinders. Like a cartoon world, where the figures are flat and outlined in black, jerking through some kind of goofy story that might be real funny if it weren't for the cartoon figures being real guys. 7:45, the black boys move down the line of chronics, taping catheters on the ones that will hold still for it. Catheters are second-hand condoms, the ends clipped off, and rubber-banded to tubes that run down pant legs to a plastic sack marked disposable, not to be reused, which it is my job to wash out at the end of each day. The black boys anchor the condom by taping it to the hairs. Old catheter chronics are hairless as babies from tape removal. 8 o'clock, the walls whir and hum into full swing. The speaker in the ceiling says, "Medications," using the big nurse's voice. We look in the glass case where she sits, but she's nowhere near the microphone. In fact, she's 10 feet away from the microphone, tutoring one of the little nurses how to prepare a neat drug tray with pills arranged orderly. The acutes line up at the glass door, A, B, C, D, then the chronics, then the wheelers. The vegetables get theirs later, mixed in a spoon of applesauce. The guys file by and get a capsule in a paper cup, throw it to the back of their throat, and get the cup filled with water by the little nurse, and wash the capsule down. On rare occasions, some fool might ask what he's being required to swallow.
Wait just a shake, honey. What are these two little red capsules in here with my vitamin?
I know him. He's a big, griping acute, already getting the reputation of being a troublemaker.
It's just medication, Mr. Tabor. Good for you. Down it goes now.
But I mean, what kind of medication? Christ, I can see that they're pills.
Just swallow it all, shall we, Mr. Tabor, just for me?
She takes a quick look at the big nurse to see how the little flirting technique she's using is accepted, then looks back at the acute. He still isn't ready to swallow something he don't know what it is, not even just for her.
Miss, I don't like to create trouble, but I don't like to swallow something without knowing what it is either. How do I know this isn't one of those funny pills that makes me something I'm not?
Don't get upset, Mr. Tabor.
Upset? All I want to know, for the love of Jesus...
But the big nurse has come up quietly, locked her hand on his arm, paralyzes him all the way to the shoulder.
That's all right, Miss Flynn, she says. If Mr. Tabor chooses to act like a child, he may have to be treated as such. We've tried to be kind and considerate with him. Obviously, that's not the answer.
Hostility. Hostility. That's the thanks we get.
You can go, Mr. Tabor, if you don't wish to take your medication orally.
All I wanted to know for...
You can go. He goes off, grumbling when she frees his arm, and spends the morning moping around the latrine, wondering about those capsules. I got away once holding one of those same red capsules under my tongue, played like I'd swallowed it,
and crushed it open later in the broom closet. For a tick of time before it all turned into white dust, I saw it was a miniature electronic element, like the ones I helped the radar corps work with in the Army. Microscopic wires and grids and transistors, this one designed to dissolve on contact with air. 8:20, the cards and puzzles go out. 8:25, some acute mentions he used to watch his sister taking her bath. The three guys at the table with him fall all over each other to see who gets to write it in the logbook. 8:30, the ward door opens, and two technicians trot in, smelling like grape wine. Technicians always move at a fast walk, or a trot, because they're always leaning so far forward they have to move fast to keep standing. They always lean forward, and they always smell like they sterilize their instruments in wine. They pull the lab door to behind them, and I sweep up close and can make out voices over the vicious zzz, 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 zzz of steel on whetstone. What we got at this ungodly hour of the morning? We gotta install an indwelling curiosity cut out in some nosy booger. Hurry up, Job, she says, and I'm not even sure we got one of the gizmos in stock. We might have to call IBM to rush one out for us. Let me check back in supply. Hey, bring out a bottle of that pure grain while you're back there. It's getting so I can't install the simplest friggin' component but what I need a bracer. Well, what the hell, it's better than garage work. Their voices are forced and too quick on the comeback to be real talk. More like cartoon comedy speech. I sweep away before I'm caught eavesdropping. The two big black boys catch Tabor in the latrine and drag him to the mattress room. He gets one a good kick in the shins. He's yelling bloody murder. I'm surprised how helpless he looks when they hold him, like he was wrapped with bands of black iron. They push him face down on the mattress. One sits on his head, and the other rips his pants open and back and peels the cloth until Tabor's peach-colored rear is framed by the ragged lettuce green. He's smothering curses into the mattress, and the black boy sitting on his head saying, "That's right, Mr. Tabor, that's right." The nurse comes down the hall, smearing Vaseline on a long needle, pulls the door shut so they're out of sight for a second, then comes right back out, wiping the needle on a shred of Tabor's pants. She's left the Vaseline jar on the room. Before the black boy can close the door after her, I see the one still sitting on Tabor's head, dabbing at him with a Kleenex. They're in there a long time before the door opens up again, and they come out, carrying him across the hall to the lab. His greens are ripped clear off now, and he's wrapped up in a damp sheet. 9 o'clock. Young residents wearing leather elbows talk to acutes for 50 minutes about what they did when they were little boys. The big nurse is suspicious of the crew-cut looks of these residents, and that 50 minutes they are on the ward is a tough time for her. While they are around, the machinery goes to fumbling, and she is scowling and making notes to check the records of these boys for old traffic violations and the like. 9:50, the residents leave, and the machine hums up smooth again. The nurse watches the day room from her glass case. The scene before her takes on that blue steel clarity again, that clean, orderly movement of a cartoon comedy. Tabor is wheeled out of the lab on a gurney bed. "We had to give him another shot when he started coming up during the spine tap," the technician tells her. "What do you say we take him right on over to Building 1 and buzz him with EST while we're at it? That way not waste the extra second all?" "I think it is an excellent suggestion. Maybe after that, take him to the electroencephalograph and check his head. We may find evidence of a need for brain work." The technicians go trotting off, pushing the man on the gurney like cartoon men, or like puppets, mechanical puppets in one of those Punch and Judy acts, where it's supposed to be funny to see the puppet beat up by the devil and swallowed headfirst by a smiling alligator. 10 o'clock, the mail comes up. Sometimes you get the torn envelope. 10:30, public relation comes in with a ladies' club following him. He claps his fat hands at the day room door. "Oh, hello, guys. Stiff lip, stiff lip. Look around, girls. Isn't it so clean, so bright? This is Miss Ratchet. I chose this ward because it's her ward. She's, girls, just like a mother. Not that I mean age, but you girls understand." Public relations shirt collar is so tight it bloats his face up when he laughs. And he's laughing most of the time I don't ever know what at. Laughing high and fast like he wishes he could stop, but can't do it. And his face bloated up red and round as a balloon with a face painted on it. He got no hair on his face, and none on his head to speak of. It looks like he glued some on once, but it kept slipping off and getting in his cuffs and his shirt pocket and down his collar. Maybe that's why he keeps his collar so tight, to keep the little pieces of hair out. Maybe that's why he laughs so much, because he isn't able to keep all the pieces out. He conducts these tours, serious women in blazer jackets nodding to him as he points out how much things have improved over the years. He points out the TV, the big leather chairs, the sanitary drinking fountains. Then they all go have coffee in the nurse's station. Sometimes he'll be all by himself and just stand in the middle of the day room and clap his hands. You can hear they are wet. Clap them two or three times till they stick. Then hold them prayer-like together under one of his chins and start spinning. Spin round and around there in the middle of the floor, looking wild and frantic at the TV, the new pictures on the walls, the drinking fountain, and laughing. What he sees that's so funny he don't ever let us in on. And the only thing I can see funny is him spinning round and around out there like a rubber toy. If you push him over, he's weighted on the bottom and straight away rocks back upright, goes to spinning again. He never, never looks at the men's faces. 10:40, 45, 50. Patients shuttle in and out to appointments in ET or OT or PT, or in queer little rooms somewhere where the walls are never the same size and the floors aren't level. The machinery sounds about you reach a steady cruising speed. The ward hums the way I heard a cotton mill hum once when the football team played a high school in California. After a good season one year, the boosters in the town were so proud and carried away that they paid to fly us to California to play a championship high school team down there. When we flew into the town, we had to go visit some local industry. Our coach was one for convincing folks that athletics was educational because of the learning afforded by travel. And every trip we took, he herded the team around to creameries and beet farms and canneries before the game. In California, it was the cotton mill. When we went in the mill, most of the team took a look and left to go sit in the bus over stud games on suitcases. But I stayed inside, over in a corner out of the way of the Negro girls, running up and down the aisles of machines. The mill put me in a kind of dream. All the humming and clicking and rattling of people and machinery, jerking around in a pattern. That's why I stayed when the others left. That, and because it reminded me somehow of the men in the tribe who'd left the village in the last days to do work on the gravel crusher for the dam. The frenzied pattern, the faces hypnotized by routine. I wanted to go out with the team, but I couldn't. It was morning in early winter, and I still had on the jacket they'd given us when we took the championship, a red and green jacket with leather sleeves and a football-shaped emblem sewn on the back telling what we'd won, and it was making a lot of the Negro girls stare. I took it off, but they kept staring. I was a whole lot bigger in those days. One of the girls left her machine and looked back and forth up the aisles to see if the foreman was around, then came over to where I was standing. She asked if we was going to play the high school that night, and she told me she had a brother played tailback for them. We talked a piece about football and the like, and I noticed how her face looked blurred, like there was a mist between me and her. It was the cotton fluff sifting from the air. I told her about the fluff. She rolled her eyes and ducked her mouth to laugh in her fist when I told her how it was like looking at her face out on a misty morning duck hunting. And she said, "Now what in the ever-loving world would you want with me out alone in a duck blind?" I told her she could take care of my gun, and the girls all over the mill went to giggling in their fists. I laughed a little myself, seeing how clever I'd been. We were still talking and laughing when she grabbed both my wrists and dug in. The features of her face snapped into brilliant focus. I saw she was terrified of something. "Do," she said to me in a whisper, "do take me, big boy, out of this here mill, out of this town, out of this life. Take me to some old duck blind someplace, someplace else. Huh, big boy, huh?" Her dark, pretty face glittered there in front of me. I stood with my mouth open, trying to think of some way to answer her. We were locked together this way for maybe a couple of seconds. Then the sound of the mill jumped a hitch, and something commenced to draw her back away from me. A string somewhere I didn't see hooked on that flowered red skirt and was tugging her back. Her fingernails peeled down my hands, and as soon as she broke contact with me, her face switched out of focus again, became soft and runny like melting chocolate behind that blowing fog of cotton. She laughed and spun around and gave me a look of her yellow leg when that skirt billowed out. She threw me a wink over her shoulder as she ran back to her machine where a pile of fiber was spilling off the table to the floor. She grabbed it up and ran feather-footed down the aisle of machines to dump the fiber in a hopper. Then she was out of sight around the corner. All those spindles reeling and wheeling and shuttles jumping around and bobbins ringing the air with string, whitewashed walls and steel-gray machines and girls in flowered skirts skipping back and forth and the whole thing webbed with flowing white lines stringing the factory together. It all stuck with me. And every once in a while, something on the ward calls it to mind. Yes, this is what I know. The ward is a factory for the combine. It's for fixing up mistakes made in the neighborhoods and in the schools and in the churches, the hospital is. When a completed product goes back out into society, all fixed up good as new, better than new sometimes, it brings joy to the big nurse's heart. Something that came in all twisted different is now a functioning, adjusted component. A credit to the whole outfit and a marvel to behold. Watch him sliding across the land with a welded grin, fitting into some nice little neighborhood where they're just now digging trenches along the street to lay pipes for city water. He's happy with it. He's adjusted to surroundings finally.
Why, I've never seen anything to beat the change in Maxwell Tabor since he's got back from that hospital. A little black and blue around the eyes, a little weight lost, and you know what? He's a new man. Gad, modern American science.
And the light is on in his basement window way past midnight every night, as the delayed reaction elements the technicians installed lend nimble skills to his fingers as he bends over the doped figure of his wife, his two little girls. Just 4 and 6, the neighbor he goes bowling with Mondays. He adjusts them like he was adjusted. This is the way they spread it. When he finally runs down after a preset number of years, the town loves him dearly, and the paper prints his picture helping the Boy Scouts last year on graveyard cleaning day, and his wife gets a letter from the principal of the high school how Maxwell Wilson Tabor was an inspirational figure to the youth of our fine community. Even the embalmers, usually a pair of penny-pinching tightwads, are swayed. Yeah, look at him there. Old Max Tabor, he was a good sort. What do you say we use that expensive 30 weight at no extra charge to his wife? No. What the dickens? Let's make it on the house. A successful dismissal like this is a product brings joy to the big nurse's heart and speaks good of her craft and the whole industry in general. Everybody's happy with the dismissal. But an admission is a different story. Even the best-behaved admission is bound to need some work to swing into routine. And also, you can never tell when just that certain one might come in who's free enough to foul things up right and left, really make a hell of a mess, and constitute a threat to the whole smoothness of the outfit. And like I explained, the big nurse gets real put out if anything keeps her outfit from running smooth. Before noontime, they're at the fog machine again, but they haven't got it turned up full. It's not so thick but what I can see if I strain real hard. One of these days I'll quit straining and let myself go completely, lose myself in the fog the way some of the other chronics have. But for the time being, I'm interested in this new man. I want to see how he takes to the group meeting coming up. 10 minutes to 1, the fog dissolves completely, and the black boys are telling acutes to clear the floor for the meeting. All the tables are carried out of the day room to the tub room across the hall. Leaves the floor, McMurphy says, like we was aiming to have us a little dance. The big nurse watches all this through her window. She hasn't moved from her spot in front of that one window for 3 solid hours, not even for lunch. The day room floor gets cleared of tables, and at 1 o'clock the doctor comes out of his office down the hall, nods once at the nurse as he goes past where she's watching out her window, and sits in his chair just to the left of the door. The patients sit down when he does, then the little nurses and the residents straggle in, When everybody's down, the big nurse gets up from behind her window and goes back to the rear of the nurse's station to that steel panel with dials and buttons on it, sets some kind of automatic pilot to run things while she's away, and comes out into the day room carrying the logbook and a basket full of notes. Her uniform, even after she's been here half a day, is still starched so stiff it don't exactly bend any place. It cracks sharp at the joints with a sound like a frozen canvas being folded. She sits just to the right of the door. Soon as she sat down, old Pete Bansini sways to his feet and starts in wagging his head and wheezing.
I'm tired. Whew. Oh, Lord. Oh, I'm awful tired.
The way he always does when there's a new man on the ward who might listen to him. The big nurse doesn't look over at Pete. She's going through the papers in her basket.
Somebody go sit beside Mr. Bansini, she says. Quiet him down so we can start the meeting.
Billy Bibbit goes. Pete has turned facing McMurphy and is lolling his head from side to side like a signal light at a railroad crossing. He worked on the railroad 30 years. Now he's wore clean out but still's functioning on the memory.
I'm tired, he says, wagging his face at McMurphy.
Take it easy, Pete, Billy says, laying a freckled hand on Pete's knee.
Awful tired.
I know, Pete,
pats the skinny knee, and Pete pulls back his face, realizes nobody's going to heed his complaint today. The nurse takes off her wristwatch and looks at the ward clock and winds the watch and sets it face toward her in the basket. She takes a folder from the basket.
Now, shall we get into the meeting?
She looks around to see if anybody else is about to interrupt her, smiling steady as her head turns in her collar. The guys won't meet her look. They're all looking for hangnails. Except McMurphy. He's got himself an armchair in the corner. Sits in it like he's claimed it for good, and he's watching her every move. He's still got his cap on, jammed tight down on his red head like he's a motorcycle racer. A deck of cards in his lap opens for a one-handed cut, then clacks shut with a sound blown up loud by the silence. The nurse's swinging eyes hang on him for a second. She's been watching him play poker all morning, and though she hasn't seen any money pass hands, she suspects he's not exactly the type that is going to be happy with the ward rule of gambling for matches only. The deck whispers open and clacks shut again, and then disappears somewhere in one of those big palms. The nurse looks at her watch again and pulls a slip of paper out of the folder she's holding, looks at it, and returns it to the folder. She puts the folder down and picks up the logbook. Ellis coughs from his place on the wall. She waits until he stops.
Now, at the close of Friday's meeting, we were discussing Mr. Harding's problem concerning his young wife. He had stated that his wife was extremely well endowed in the bosom, and that this made him uneasy because she drew stares from men on the street.
She starts opening to places in the logbook. Little slips of paper stick out of the top of the book to mark the pages.
According to the notes listed by various patients in the log, Mr. Harding has been heard to say that she damn well gives the bastards reason to stare. He has also been heard to say that he may give her reason to seek further sexual attention. He has been heard to say, my dear sweet but illiterate wife thinks any word or gesture that does not smack of brickyard brawn and brutality is a word or gesture of weak dandyism.
She continues reading silently from the book for a while, then closes it.
He has also stated that his wife's ample bosom at times gives him a feeling of inferiority.
So, does anyone care to touch upon this subject further? Harding shuts his eyes, and nobody else says anything.
McMurphy looks around at the other guys, waiting to see if anybody is going to answer the nurse, then holds his hand up and snaps his fingers, like a school kid in class. The nurse nods at him.
Mr. McMurray.
Touch upon what?
What? Touch?
You ask, I believe, does anyone care to touch upon
the subject, Mr. McMurray, the subject of Mr. Harding's problem with his wife?
Oh, I thought you mean touch upon or something else.
Now what could you?
But she stops. She was almost flustered for a second there. Some of the acutes hide grins,
and McMurphy takes a huge stretch, yawns, winks at Harding. Then the nurse, calm as anything, puts the logbook back in the basket and takes out another folder and opens it and starts reading. McMurray, Randall Patrick, committed by the state from the Pendleton Farm for correction, for diagnosis and possible treatment. 35 years old, never married. Distinguished Service Cross in Korea for leading an escape from a communist prison camp. A dishonorable discharge, afterward for insubordination. Followed by a history of street brawls and barroom fights and a series of arrests for drunkenness, assault, and battery, disturbing the peace, repeated gambling, and one arrest for rape. Rape? The doctor perks up. Statutory, with a girl of,
whoa, couldn't make that stick,
McMurphy says to the doctor.
Girl wouldn't testify.
With a child of 15.
Said she was 17, doc, and she was plenty willing.
A court doctor's examination of the child proved entry, repeated entry. The record states,
so willing, in fact, I took to sewing my pants shut.
The child refused to testify in spite of the doctor's findings. There seemed to be intimidation. Defendant left town shortly after the trial.
Whew, boy, I had to leave, doc. Let me tell you.
He leans forward with an elbow on a knee, lowering his voice to the doctor across the room.
That little hustler would have actually burnt me to a frazzle by the time she reached legal 16. She got to where she was tripping me and beating me to the floor.
The nurse closes up the folder and passes it across the doorway to the doctor. Our new admission, Dr. Spivey. Just like she's got a man folded up inside that yellow paper and can pass him on to be looked over. I thought I might brief you on his record later today, but as he seems to insist on asserting himself in the group meeting, we might as well dispense with him now. The doctor fishes his glasses from his coat pocket by pulling on the string, works them on his nose in front of his eyes. They're tipped a little to the right, but he leans his head to the left and brings them level. He's smiling a little as he turns through the folder, just as tickled by this new man's brassy way of talking right up as the rest of us. But just like the rest of us, he's careful not to let himself come right out and laugh. The doctor closes the folder when he gets to the end and puts his glasses back in his pocket. He looks to where McMurphy is still leaned out at him from across the day room.
You've, it seems, no other psychiatric history, Mr. McMurray?
McMurphy, doc.
Oh, but I thought the nurse was saying...
He opens the folder again, fishes out those glasses, looks the record over for another minute before he closes it, and puts his glasses back in his pocket.
Yes, McMurphy. That is correct. I beg your pardon.
That's okay, doc.
It was the lady there that started it, made the mistake. I've known some people inclined to do that. I had this uncle whose name was Hallahan, and he went with a woman once who kept acting like she couldn't remember his name right and calling him Hooligan just to get his goat. Went on for months before he stopped her.
Stopped her good, too.
Oh? How did he stop her?
The doctor asks. McMurphy grins and rubs his nose with his thumb.
Now I can't be telling that. I keep Unc Callahan's method a strict secret, you see, in case I need to use it myself someday.
He says it right at the nurse. She smiles right back at him, and he looks over at the doctor.
Now, what was he asking about my record, doc?
Yes, I was wondering if you've had any previous psychiatric history, any analysis, any time spent in any other institution?
Well, counting state and county coolers.
Mental institutions.
Ah, no, if that's the case. This is my first trip, but I am crazy, doc. I swear I am. Well, here, let me show you here. I believe that other doctor at the work farm?
He gets up, slips the deck of cards in the pocket of his jacket, and comes across the room to lean over the doctor's shoulder and thumb through the folder on his lap.
Believe he wrote something back at the back here somewhere.
Yes, I missed that. Just a moment.
The doctor fishes his glasses out again and puts them on and looks to where McMurphy is pointing.
Right here, doc. The nurse left this part out while she was summarizing my record where it says, Mr. McMurphy has evidenced repeated, I just want to make sure I'm understood completely, doc, repeated outbreaks of passion that suggests the possible diagnosis of psychopath. He told me that psychopath means I fight and fuck... Pardon me, ladies. Means I am, he put it, overzealous in my sexual relations.
Doctor, is that real serious?
He asks it with such a little boy look of worry and concern all over his broad, tough face that the doctor can't help bending his head to hide another little snicker in his collar, and his glasses fall from his nose dead center back in his pocket. All of the acutes are smiling too now, and even some of the chronics.
I mean that overzealousness, Doc. Have you ever been troubled by it?
The doctor wipes his eyes.
No, Mr. McMurphy, I'll admit I haven't. I am interested, however, that the doctor at the work farm added this statement. Don't overlook the possibility that this man might be feigning psychosis to escape the drudgery of the work farm.
He looks up at McMurphy.
And what about that, Mr. McMurphy?
Doctor!
He stands up to his full height, wrinkles his forehead, and holds out both arms, open and honest to all the wide world.
Do I look like a sane man?
The doctor is working so hard to keep from giggling again he can't answer. McMurphy pivots away from the doctor and asks the same thing of the big nurse.
Do I?
Instead of answering, she stands up and takes the manila folder from the doctor and puts it back in the basket under her watch. She sits back down.
Perhaps, doctor, you should advise Mr. McMurray on the protocol of these group meetings.
Ma'am,
McMurphy says,
have I told you about my Uncle Hallahan and the woman who used to screw up his name?
She looks at him for a long time without her smile. She has the ability to turn her smile into whatever expression she wants to use on somebody, but the look she turns it into is no different, just a calculated and mechanical expression to serve her purpose. Finally, she says,
I beg your pardon, McMurphy.
She turns back to the doctor.
Now, doctor, if you would explain.
The doctor folds his hands and leans back.
Yes, I suppose what I should do is explain the complete theory of our therapeutic community while we're at it, though I usually save it until later. Yes, a good idea, Miss Ratchet, a fine idea.
Certainly the theory too, doctor, but what I had in mind was the rule that the patients remain seated during the course of the meeting.
Yes, of course, then I will explain the theory. Mr. McMurphy, one of the first things is that the patients remain seated during the course of the meeting. It's the only way, you see, for us to maintain order.
Sure, doctor, I just got up to show you that thing in my record book.
He goes over to his chair, gives another big stretch and yawn, sits down, and moves around for a while like a dog coming to rest. When he's comfortable, he looks over at the doctor, waiting.
As to the theory, the doctor takes a deep, happy breath.
Fuck the wife, Ruckley says.
McMurphy hides his mouth behind the back of his hand and calls across the ward to Ruckley in a scratchy whisper.
Whose wife?
And Martini's head snaps up, eyes wide and staring.
Yeah,
he says.
Whose wife? Oh, her? Yeah, I see her. Yeah.
I'd give a lot to have that man's eyes,
McMurphy says of Martini, and then doesn't say anything all the rest of the meeting. Just sits and watches, and doesn't miss a thing that happens or a word that's said. The doctor talks about his theory until the big nurse finally decides he's used up time enough, and asks him to hush so they can get on to Harding, and they talk the rest of the meeting about that. McMurphy sits forward in his chair a couple of times during the meeting, like he might have something to say, but he decides better and leans back. There's a puzzled expression coming over his face. Something strange is going on here, he's finding out. He can't quite put his finger on it, like the way nobody will laugh. Now he thought sure there would be a laugh when he asked Ruckley whose wife, but there wasn't even a sign of one. The air is pressed in by the walls, too tight for laughing. There's something strange about a place where the men won't let themselves loose and laugh. Something strange about the way they all knuckle under to that smiling, flower-faced old mother there with the two red lipstick and the two big boobs. And he thinks he'll just wait a while to see what the story is in this new place before he makes any kind of play. That's a good rule for a smart gambler. Look the game over a while before you draw yourself a hand. I've heard that theory of the therapeutic community enough times to repeat it forwards and backwards. How a guy has to learn to get along in a group before he'll be able to function in a normal society. How the group can help the guy by showing him where he's out of place. How society is what decides who's sane and who isn't,
so you got to measure up. All that stuff. Every time we get a new patient on the ward, the doctor goes into the theory with both feet. It's pretty near the only time he takes things over and runs the meeting. He tells how the goal of the therapeutic community is a democratic ward, run completely by the patients and their votes, working toward making worthwhile citizens to turn back outside onto the street. Any little gripe, any little grievance, anything you want changed, he says, should be brought up before the group and discussed instead of letting it fester inside of you. Also, you should feel at ease in your surroundings to the extent you can freely discuss emotional problems in front of patients and staff. Talk, he says, discuss, confess. And if you hear a friend say something during the course of your everyday conversation, then list it in the logbook for the staff to see. It's not, as the movies call it, squealing. It's helping your fellow. Bring these old sins into the open where they can be washed by the sight of all. And participate in group discussion. Help yourself and your friends probe into the secrets of the subconscious. There should be no need for secrets among friends. Our intention, he usually ends by saying, is to make this as much like your own democratic free neighborhoods as possible. A little world inside that is a made-to-scale prototype of the big world outside that you will one day be taking your place in again. He's maybe got more to say, but at this point the big nurse usually hushes him. And in the lull, old Pete stands up and wigwags that battered copper pot head and tells everybody how tired he is, and the nurse tells somebody to go hush him up too, so the meeting can continue, and Pete is generally hushed and the meeting goes on. Once, just one time that I can remember, 4 or 5 years back, did it go any different. The doctor had finished his spiel, and the nurse had opened right up with, "Now, who will start? Let out those old secrets." And she'd put all the acutes in a trance by sitting there in silence for 20 minutes after the question, quiet as an electric alarm about to go off, waiting for somebody to start telling something about themselves. Her eyes swept back and forth over them as steady as a turning beacon. The day room was clamped silent for 20 long minutes, with all of the patients stunned where they sat. When 20 minutes had passed, she looked at her watch and said, "Am I to take it that there's not a man among you that has committed some act that he has never admitted?" She reached in the basket for the logbook. "Must we go over past history?" That triggered something, some acoustic device in the walls, rigged to turn on at just the sound of those words coming from her mouth. The acutes stiffened. Their mouths opened in unison. Her sweeping eyes stopped on the first man along the wall. His mouth worked. "I robbed a cash register in a service station." She moved to the next man. "I tried to take my little sister to bed." Her eyes clicked to the next man. Each one jumped like a shooting gallery target. "I, one time, wanted to take my brother to bed. I killed my cat when I was 6. Oh, God, forgive me. I stoned her to death and said my neighbor did it. I lied about trying. I did take my sister. So did I. So did I. And me. And me." It was better than she dreamed. They were all shouting to outdo one another, going further and further, no way of stopping, telling things that wouldn't ever let them look one another in the eye again. The nurse nodding at each confession and saying, "Yes. Yes. Yes." Then old Pete was on his feet.
"I'm tired,"
was what he shouted, a strong, angry copper tone to his voice that no one had ever heard before. Everyone hushed. They were somehow ashamed. It was as if he had suddenly said something that was real and true and important, and it had put all their childish hollering to shame. The big nurse was furious. She swiveled and glared at him, the smile dripping over her chin. She'd just had it going so good. "Somebody see to poor Mr. Bansini," she said. 2 or 3 got up. They tried to soothe him, pat him on his shoulder, but Pete wasn't being hushed.
"Tired! Tired!"
he kept on. Finally, the nurse sent one of the black boys to take him out of the day room by force. She forgot that the black boys didn't hold any control over people like Pete. Pete's been a chronic all his life. Even though he didn't come into the hospital till he was better than 50, he'd always been a chronic. His head has 2 big dents, one on each side, where the doctor who was with his mother at borning time pinched his skull, trying to pull him out. Pete had looked out first and seen all the delivery room machinery waiting for him and somehow realized what he was being born into and had grabbed onto everything handy in there to try to stave off being born. The doctor reached in and got him by the head with a set of dulled ice tongs and jerked him loose and figured everything was all right. But Pete's head was still too new and soft as clay, and when it set, those two dents left by the tongs stayed. And this made him simple to where it took all his straining effort and concentration and willpower just to do the tasks that came easy to a kid of six. But one good thing, being simple like that put him out of the clutch of the Combine. They weren't able to mold him into a slot. So they let him get a simple job on the railroad, where all he had to do was sit in a little clapboard house way out in the sticks on a lonely switch and wave a red lantern at the trains if the switch was one way, and a green one if it was the other, and a yellow one if there was a train someplace up ahead. And he did it, with main force and a gut power they couldn't mash out of his head, out by himself on that switch, and he never had any controls installed. That's why the black boy didn't have any say over him. But the black boy didn't think of that right off any more than the nurse did when she ordered Pete removed from the day room. The black boy walked right up and gave Pete's arm a jerk toward the door, just like you jerk the reins on a plow horse to turn him.
"That's right, Pete. Let's go to the dorm. You're disturbing everybody."
Pete shook his arm loose. "I'm tired," he warned.
"Come on, old man. You make no fuss. Let's go to bed and be still like a good boy."
"Tired."
"I said you're going to the dorm, old man."
The black boy jerked at his arm again, and Pete stopped wig-wagging his head. He stood up straight and steady, and his eyes snapped clear. Usually Pete's eyes are half shut and all murked up, like there's milk in them, but this time they came clear as blue neon, and the hand on that arm the black boy was holding commenced to swell up. The staff and most of the rest of the patients were talking among themselves, not paying any attention to this old guy and his old song about being tired, figuring he'd be quieted down as usual and the meeting would go on. They didn't see the hand on the end of that arm pumping bigger and bigger as he clenched and unclenched it. I was the only one saw it. I saw it swell and clench shut, flow in front of my eyes, become smooth, hard, a big rusty iron ball at the end of a chain. I stared at it and waited while the black boy gave Pete's arm another jerk toward the dorm.
"Old man, I say you got—"
He saw the hand. He tried to edge back away from it, saying,
"You're a good boy, Peter,"
but he was a shade too late. Pete had that big iron ball swinging all the way from his knees. The black boy whammed flat against the wall and stuck, then slid down to the floor like the wall there was greased. I heard tubes pop and short all over inside that wall, and the plaster cracked just the shape of how he hit. The other two, the least one and the other big one, stood stunned. The nurse snapped her fingers, and they sprang into motion, instant movement sliding across the floor, the little one beside the other like an image in a reducing mirror. They were almost to Pete when it suddenly struck them what the other boy should have known, that Pete wasn't wired under control like the rest of us, that he wasn't about to mind just because they gave him an order or gave his arm a jerk. If they were to take him, they'd have to take him like you take a wild bear or bull, and with one of their number out cold against the baseboards, the other two black boys didn't care for the odds. This thought got them both at once, and they froze, the big one and his tiny image, in exactly the same position, left foot forward, right hand out, halfway between Pete and the big nurse. That iron ball swinging in front of them and that snow-white anger behind them, they shook and smoked, and I could hear gears grinding. I could see them twitch with confusion, like machines throttled full ahead and with the brake on. Pete stood there in the middle of the floor, swinging that ball back and forth at his side, all leaned over to its weight. Everybody was watching him now. He looked from the big black boy to the little one, and when he saw they weren't about to come any closer, he turned to the patients.
"You see, it's a lot of baloney," he told them. "It's all a lot of baloney."
The big nurse had slid from her chair and was working toward her wicker bag leaning at the door.
"Yes, yes, Mr. Bansini," she crooned. "Now if you'll just be calm."
"That's all it is, nothing but a lot of baloney."
His voice lost its copper strength, and became strained and urgent, like he didn't have much time to finish what he had to say.
You see, I can't help it. I can't. Don't you see? I was born dead. Not you. He wasn't born dead. It's been hard.
He started to cry. He couldn't make the words come out right anymore. He opened and closed his mouth to talk, but he couldn't sort the words into sentences anymore. He shook his head to clear it and blinked at the acutes.
I tell ya.
He began slumping over again, and his iron ball shrank back to a hand. He held it cupped out in front of him like he was offering something to the patients.
I can't help it. I was born a miscarriage. I had so many insults, I died. I was born dead. I can't help it. I'm tired. I'm give up trying. You got chances. I had so many insults, I was born dead. You got it easy. I was born dead and life was hard. I'm tired. I'm tired of talking and standing up. I've been dead 55 years.
The big nurse got him clear across the room, right through his greens. She jumped back without getting the needle pulled out after the shot, and it hung there from his pants like a little tail of glass and steel. Old Pete slumping farther and farther forward, not from the shot, but from the effort. The last couple of minutes had worn him out finally and completely, once and for all. You could just look at him and tell he was finished. So there wasn't really any need for the shot. His head had already commenced to wag back and forth, and his eyes were murky. By the time the nurse eased back in to get the needle, he was bent so far forward he was crying directly on the floor without wetting his face, tears spotting a wide area as he swung his head back and forth, spatting, spatting, in an even pattern on the day room floor, like he was sewing them. He said. He didn't flinch when she jerked the needle out. He had come to life for maybe a minute to try to tell us something. Something none of us cared to listen to or try to understand, and the effort had drained him dry. That shot in his hip was as wasted as if she'd squirted it in a dead man. No heart to pump it. No vein to carry it up to his head. No brain up there for it to mortify with its poison. She'd just as well shot it in a dried-out old cadaver.
I'm tired.
Now, I think if you two boys are brave enough, Mr. Bansini will go to bed like a good fellow.
Awful tired.
And Aide Williams is coming around, Dr. Spivey. See to him, won't you? Here, his watch is broken and he's cut his arm. Pete never tried anything like that again, and he never will. Now when he starts acting up during a meeting and they try to hush him, he always hushes. He'll still get up from time to time and wag his head and let us know how tired he is, but it's not a complaint or excuse or warning anymore. He's finished with that. It's like an old clock that won't tell time but won't stop neither. With the hands bent out of shape and the face bare of numbers and the alarm bell rusted silent, an old worthless clock that just keeps ticking and cuckooing without meaning nothing. The group is still tearing into poor Harding when 2 o'clock rolls around. At 2 o'clock, the doctor begins to squirm around in his chair. The meetings are uncomfortable for the doctor unless he's talking about his theory. He'd rather spend his time down in his office drawing on graphs. He squirms around and finally clears his throat, and the nurse looks at her watch and tells us to bring the tables back in from the tub room and we'll resume this discussion again at 1 tomorrow. The acutes click out of their trance, look for an instant in Harding's direction. Their faces burn with a shame like they have just woke up to the fact they've been played for suckers again. Some of them go to the tub room across the hall to get the tables. Some wander over to the magazine racks and show a lot of interest in the old McCall's magazines, but what they're all really doing is avoiding Harding.
They've been maneuvered again into grilling one of their friends like he was a criminal, and they were all prosecutors and judge and jury. For 45 minutes, they've been chopping a man to pieces, almost as if they enjoyed it, shooting questions at him. What's he think is the matter with him that he can't please the little lady? Why does he insist she has never had anything to do with another man? How's he expect to get well if he doesn't answer honestly? Questions and insinuations. Till now they feel bad about it, and they don't want to be made more uncomfortable by being near him. McMurphy's eyes follow all of this. He doesn't get out of his chair. He looks puzzled again. He sits in his chair for a while, watching the acutes, scuffing that deck of cards up and down the red stubble on his chin, then finally stands up from his armchair, yawns and stretches and scratches his belly button with the corner of a card. Then he puts the deck in his pocket and walks over to where Harding is off by himself, sweated, to his chair. McMurphy looks down at Harding a minute, then laps his big hand over the back of a nearby wooden chair, swings it around so the back is facing Harding, and straddles it like he'd straddle a tiny horse. Harding hasn't noticed a thing. McMurphy slaps his pockets till he finds his cigarettes and takes one out and lights it. He holds it out in front of him and frowns at the tip, licks his thumb and finger, and arranges the fire to suit him. Each man seems unaware of the other. I can't even tell if Harding's noticed McMurphy at all. Harding's got his thin shoulders folded nearly together around himself, like green wings, and he's sitting very straight near the edge of his chair, with his hands trapped between his knees. He's staring straight ahead, humming to himself, trying to look calm, but he's chewing at his cheeks, and this gives him a funny skull grin, not calm at all. McMurphy puts his cigarette back between his teeth and folds his hands over the wooden chair back and leans his chin on them, squinting one eye against the smoke. He looks at Harding with his other eye a while, then starts talking with that cigarette wagging up and down in his lips.
Well, say, buddy, is this the way these legal meetings usually go?
Usually go? Harding's humming stops. He's not chewing his cheeks anymore, but he still stares ahead, past McMurphy's shoulder.
Is this the usual procedure for these group therapy shindigs? Bunch of chickens at a pecking party?
Harding's head turns with a jerk, and his eyes find McMurphy, like it's the first time he knows that anybody's sitting in front of him. His face creases in the middle when he bites his cheeks again, and this makes it look like he's grinning. He pulls his shoulders back and scoots to the back of the chair and tries to look relaxed.
A pecking party? I fear your quaint down-home speech is wasted on me, my friend. I have not the slightest inclination what you're talking about.
Why, then I'll just explain it to you.
McMurphy raises his voice. Though he doesn't look at the other acutes listening behind him, it's them he's talking to.
The flock gets sight of a spot of blood on some chicken, and they all go to pecking at it, see, till they rip the chicken to shreds, blood and bones and feathers. But usually a couple of the flock get spotted in the fracas, then it's their turn. And a few more get spots and gets pecked to death, and more and more. Oh, a pecking party can wipe out the whole flock in a matter of a few hours, buddy. I seen it. A mighty awesome sight. The only way to prevent it with chickens is to clip blinders on them so they can't see.
Harding laces his long fingers around a knee and draws the knee toward him, leaning back in the chair.
A pecking party. That certainly is a pleasant analogy, my friend.
And that's just exactly what that meeting I just sat through reminded me of, buddy, if you want to know the dirty truth. It reminded me of a flock of dirty chickens.
So that makes me the chicken with the spot of blood, friend?
That's right, buddy.
They're still grinning at each other, but their voices have dropped so low and taut, I have to sweep over closer to them with my broom to hear. The other acutes are moving up closer, too.
And you want to know something else, buddy? You want to know who pecks that first peck?
Harding waits for him to go on.
It's that old nurse. That's who.
There's a whine of fear over the silence. I hear the machinery in the walls catch and go on. Harding is having a tough time holding his hand still, but he keeps trying to act calm.
So, he says, it's as simple as that. As stupidly simple as that. You're on our ward 6 hours and have already simplified all the work of Freud, Jung, and Maxwell Jones and summed it up in one analogy. It's a pecking party.
I'm not talking about Fred Young and Maxwell Jones, buddy. I'm just talking about that crummy meeting and what that nurse and those other bastards did to you, did in spades.
Did to me?
That's right, did. Did every chance they got, did you coming and did you going.
You must have done something to make a passel of enemies here in this place, buddy, because it seems there's sure a passel got it in for you.
Why, this is incredible. You completely disregard, completely overlook, and disregard the fact that what the fellows were doing today was for my own benefit? That any question or discussion raised by Miss Ratchet or the rest of the staff is done solely for therapeutic reasons?
You must not have heard a word of Dr. Spivey's theory of the therapeutic community, or not have had the education to comprehend it, if you did. I'm disappointed in you, my friend. Oh, very disappointed. I had judged from our encounter this morning that you were more intelligent. An illiterate clod, perhaps, certainly a backwoods braggart with no more sensitivity than a goose, but basically intelligent nevertheless. But, observant and insightful though I usually am, I still make mistakes.
The hell with you, buddy.
Oh, yes, I forgot to add that I noticed your primitive brutality also this morning. Psychopath, with definite sadistic tendencies. Probably motivated by an unreasoning egomania, yes. As you see, all these natural talents certainly qualify you as a competent therapist, and render you quite capable of criticizing Miss Ratchet's meeting procedure, in spite of the fact that she is a highly regarded psychiatric nurse with 20 years in the field. Yes, with your talent, my friend, you could work subconscious miracles. Soothe the aching id. And heal the wounded superego. You could probably bring about a cure for the whole ward, vegetables and all. In 6 short months, ladies and gentlemen, or your money back. Instead of rising to the argument, McMurphy just keeps on looking at Harding. Finally asks in a level voice, "And you really think this crap that went on in the meeting today is bringing about some kind of cure, doing some kind of good? What other reason would we have for submitting ourselves to it, my friend? The staff desires our cure as much as we do. They aren't monsters. Miss Ratchet may be a strict middle-aged lady, but she's not some kind of giant monster of the poultry clan bent on sadistically pecking out our eyes. You can't believe that of her, can you?
No, buddy. Not that. She ain't pecking at your eyes. That's not what she's pecking at."
Harding flinches, and I see his hands begin to creep out from between his knees, like white spiders from between 2 moss-covered tree limbs, up the limbs, toward the joining at the trunk.
"Not our eyes?"
he says. "Pray then, where is Miss Ratchet pecking, my friend?" McMurphy grinned.
"Why, don't you know, buddy?"
"No, of course I don't know. I mean, if you
At your balls, buddy. At your ever-loving balls."
The spiders reach the joining of the trunk and settle there twitching. Harding tries to grin, but his face and lips are so white the grin is lost. He stares at McMurphy. McMurphy takes the cigarette out of his mouth and repeats what he said.
"Right at your balls."
"No, that nurse ain't some kind of monster chicken, buddy. What she is a ball cutter. I've seen 1,000 of them, old and young, men and women, seen them all over the country and in the homes. People who try to make you weak, so they can get you to toe the line, to follow their rules, to live like they want you to. And the best way to do this, to get you to knuckle under, is to weaken you by getting you where it hurts the worst. You ever been kneading the nuts in a brawl, buddy? Stops you cold, don't it? There's nothing worse. Makes you sick. Saps every bit of strength you got. If you're up against a guy who wants to win by making you weaker instead of making himself stronger, then watch for his knee. He's going to go for your vitals. And that's what that old buzzard is doing, going for your vitals." Harding's face is still colorless, but he's got control of his hands again. They flip loosely before him, trying to toss off what McMurphy has been saying.
"Our dear Miss Ratchet, our sweet, smiling, tender angel of mercy, Mother Ratchet, a ball cutter?
Why, friend, that's most unlikely. Buddy, don't give me that tender little mother crap. She may be a mother, but she's big as a damn barn and tough as knife metal. She fooled me with that kindly little old mother bit for maybe 3 minutes when I came in this morning, but no longer. I don't think she's really fooled any of you guys for any 6 months or a year, neither. Hoo-wee, I've seen some bitches in my time, but she takes the cake.
A bitch. But a moment ago, she was a ball cutter, then a buzzard, or was it a chicken? Your metaphors are bumping into each other, my friend. The hell with that. She's a bitch, and a buzzard, and a ball cutter. And don't kid me, you know.